ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
He was the man who stole the plans for the atomic bomb. A brilliant physicist, a devoted communist. A spy hiding inside the most secret project on Earth. This is the story of Klaus Fuchs, a man who believed he could serve two masters, science and the Soviets. To hear it, search for The Bomb on the ABC Listen app. I wonder what it feels like when your novel, this very personal, solitary project born from your imagination, gets the Hollywood treatment. Hello, I'm Claire Nichols, and this is The Book Show, where I bring you conversations with your favourite fiction writers. Today, two best-selling authors, David Nichols and Leanne Moriarty, are going to tell you what it's like to see their stories go from the page to the screen. David Nichols is best known for his novel One Day, that has been adapted to film and to television, while Australia's Leanne Moriarty has seen every one of her books optioned for the screen and really hit the big time with the starry TV adaptation of her novel Big Little Lies. I spoke to David and Leanne on Gadigal Land at the Sydney Writers' Festival. Okay, Leanne, I want to get in the showbiz mode. We're going to go to the Emmys. Big Little Lies is in the running for Best Series. You're there, Nicole Kidman's there, Reese Witherspoon's there. What does that feel like?
I always remember seeing Emma Thompson. She was interviewed and she was talking about how when you go to LA, there's always somebody who's keen to make sure you know you're not as important as you think you are. And so in the lead up to the Emmys, I was getting these emails from somebody at HBO and she was saying, so just so you know, you won't be invited to this particular ball. And I'd never heard of the ball, but it was very important to her that I knew I was not invited to the ball. And so she kept saying it until finally I sent back a response that said, I understand, I won't be going to the ball. Yours, Cinderella.
I didn't go to that ball either.
So then when we went, so I had, you know, hours of makeup and hair to make myself look barely acceptable. My husband got out of the shower, ran his hand across the top of his head, looked fantastic. There are pictures of him holding the Emmy as if he'd won it himself. Yeah. And then we went in a car to the Emmys and we were stopped by a policeman. And the policeman said to the driver, have you got a celebrity in the back there? And the driver said, nope. So then he said, so therefore you've got to go this way. So you've got to park somewhere different, walk somewhere different. I then sat far back and then, yes, went up on stage. But no, it was great.
David, have you been made to feel honest at an awards show?
Oh, yeah. No, I was just thinking of the premiere for Star for 10 in New York, you know, premiere of the film based on your book, and you've written the script, and you're on the red carpet, and there are photographs on the internet of me with a very, very, very famous film star with, like, his arm around my shoulder and kind of thumbs up like this. And as soon as we walked off the red carpet, he said, I'm sorry, I have no idea who you are.
I mean, you were an actor before you were a writer.
Barely, but yes, technically, yeah.
Does the glitz and glamour of a showbiz life appeal to you?
No, I mean, I tend to stay away from the actors. I love actors, but I'm often an actor will have a script note, and I find it almost impossible to say no to famous people. So, you know, there's a voice in my head that's always saying, you know, you've been on telly. And so I also think a screenwriter or the author of the novel on set is the only person who really doesn't have anything to do. You just get in the way, you distract people, you make them nervous, you make them self-conscious. So I stay away. And I think especially that thing of avoiding the actors and letting that be the responsibility of the director has always been my approach, and that makes sense. And it's also to do with a certain shyness on my part. I'm not relaxed in that environment, so I tend to stay away.
I love that you're a shy former actor.
Well, that was one of the problems. It wasn't the biggest problem. But,
but your first writing was for screen before you wrote novels, right? So can you tell me about that phase of your life?
Sure. I went from the short version that I went from acting to script reading to script editing, and then through the encouragement of friends who really wanted me to stop acting into script writing. And my first big break actually was on a show called Cold Feet, which wasn't my show, but was written and created by Mike Bullen, who I think lives in the city. I wonder if Mike's here tonight. That was a huge break for me. I joined... Mike wrote the first two series and he created the show, and I joined on the third series and wrote four episodes. And that led to, you know, me having a kind of... an inconsistent career as a TV writer, and it was some way into that that I wrote a show that didn't get recommissioned, and suddenly I had nothing to do, and so I started writing what I thought might be a dramatic monologue, and which turned into a novel, my first novel, Start of a Ten. But yeah, that was my big break, and I guess I did bring some of that approach to the writing of my first novel, in that it was very structured before I started writing. You know, I'd written character Bibles. I thought of it in terms of scenes and set pieces and acts. So there was a kind of crossover, I think, in the techniques I'd learned as a screenwriter and the approach I took to novel writing. I think it's much easier that way around. I think novelists who turn to screenwriting are taken aback by all the things that they can no longer do. So the two have always intertwined for me in a really interesting way.
Do you still use that approach when you're writing a novel now, that kind of very strict theatrical approach?
It's slightly different now. What I do is I write for a year and I just write sketches. I write bits of dialogue, character sketches, descriptive passages. I write a passage in the first person, then the third person, past tense, present tense. I build the characters and work out who they are, which is a kind of televisual approach. You know, when you on a long-running show, you'll have the Bible, which is all the characters' backgrounds, their biographies, their family stories, their personal histories. I don't write it as a formal document that I could present to anyone else, but I make sure that I know it before I write chapter one. And these two documents I work on simultaneously, the notebook and the actual novel itself.
Are you as strict with your preparation for a book, Leanne?
No, I'm not. I'll tell you my Marion Keyes story. So my husband became very supportive of my career when he learned that Marion had bought her husband a Maserati. And he was once at a dinner party and I wasn't there, and he was asked exactly that question, how does she go about writing a novel? Because they heard that I was a writer. And he apparently proceeded to explain how I went about writing a novel. He had never once asked me how I wrote a novel. And he apparently spoke at some length. And he described the sort of things you just said about how she does it. She plans it all out, and she does chapter by chapter plans. And he came home and told me that. And I said, but I don't. I just make it up as I go along. And he said, well, I think you should. I said, I think if you planned, I might get my Maserati a bit faster. So no, for me, I just start with the premise. So my sister, Jacqueline Moriarty, she likes to plan and have it all planned out beforehand. And we've both tried each other's way of writing and we can't do it. I can't work out what's happening and I need to write it to find out what's going to happen, which is why I have no interest in writing my own adaptations, because I know what's going to happen.
Mm. Well, look, Maserati or not, I think we can say that your approach is working, Leanne. I'm really hoping you can both explain to us what this process is when a book gets taken from the page to the screen. Leanne, let's talk about you. Which of your novels was the first to get optioned for the screen?
I think the first one was actually Three Wishes many, many years ago. And I know because I was single at the time, and I was thinking, this would be a great way, because I was told you're going to meet this man who wants to option your book. And I thought, this would be a great way to meet somebody. And he met me at... And I was thinking, what does he want... that's what I've never understood, the point of the meetings.
Yes.
You know, what, there's a lot what of do meetings. They want from you?
Yeah.
Just... do they? So I was confused by that. So he came into the cafe, and I can always remember there was a ray of sunlight that hit his wedding ring.
Oh.
And so I was annoyed with him for not being single. And he came in, and then he said he wanted to option it, and he did option it. He paid a small amount, and then nothing ever came from it again, which I think is the normal way that the option... So they have... the right to, so that's normally for 18 months, that within that time they can work on it, and then and they pay you a small amount of money that nobody else can work on it. Do you think that's the right way to describe
an
option?
Yeah, no, that is exactly it. And you know, the development process is very slow, so sometimes there are extensions, and then once, if it does get made, I mean, most books that are optioned don't get made, and if it does get made, then they own the rights, and it becomes, you sort of lose control. I mean, I don't own One Day anymore, Universal does. So that's a very, you have to think very carefully before you make that kind of commitment.
But I guess when it's the first time that that's happened, you're eager and giddy, and you're like, sure, take the book, right?
Well, the big question, of course, is who's going to adapt it? And you have to make that decision. And I think a lot of novelists, you know, you really tear this thing to pieces. It's a very brutal process. You have to throw away so much, especially if you're turning a book into a film. You know, it's a much more natural to turn... The form of a novel is a much closer match to a TV series than it is to a film. A film tends to have a single protagonist and a journey with a series of obstacles and three acts. And some novels fit that pattern, but most novels are more episodic. You know, they have chapters which correspond to episodes, they have set pieces, they have little narrative hooks. They have multiple character strands and story strands. So it's natural. When I started writing fiction, film was usually the way to go. You know, will this be a movie? And now the reason adaptations tend to be more satisfying now is because they have this different form and a larger canvas.
Mm. Leanne, you said earlier that you're not interested in adapting your own work for the screen. Is it something that producers want from you to do that?
They've normally asked, but yeah, and I've tried to sort of analyse myself and think, why don't you want to do it? But I feel a real resistance, and I've thought, is it just because you don't know the formatting? There seem to be a lot of tabs in a screenplay, and
yes.
I assume there's software.
Yes.
But surely it's more... I feel such a resistance. I feel like... do you hate writing a synopsis of your own work? That's the feeling I get.
There's so many things you really... I mean, you, as a novelist, you have such power. You have such freedom and power. And then as soon as you become the screenwriter, people who are paying for the film or the TV show can say, we're really not sure about this scene, and this doesn't really work, and can we have new dialogue here, and this character's a bit unsympathetic. And there's a voice in your head which just said, well, you know, it works in the novel. And you have to overcome that and accept that a different form will require a different approach, will require new scenes, will require cuts. I mean, the things you lose when you adapt a novel, you lose all the interior monologue, you lose memories, you lose metaphors and similes, you lose observations, you lose most action that doesn't move the story forward. So it's a very brutal process. It's like pulling out your own teeth. You know, you have to be really, really, really tough. It's very hard to show a child growing up on the screen. It's very hard to show... In a novel, it's very easy to say, you know, she remembered a day when. And what are you going to do with that on screen? You have to lose it. A lot of good jokes go because they're jokes that can never be said out loud. They're characters' observations that don't really serve the scene. And so it can be a very shocking process, especially because you're a very small part of it. You know, you're then... A novel is a wonderful form for showing what characters think and feel. And a screenplay is an instruction manual. It's not a work of literature in itself. It's something you can give to people, which has an infinite number of possibilities, depending on who you give it to. You know, it can go wrong in all kinds of ways because of casting or the director's choices or the way it's shot. And it's very, very, very tough to lose that control and power.
You have adapted your own work. So Starter for 10, you adapted the film of One Day, you adapted.
Yeah.
You were telling me backstage you've also got an adaptation of Sweet Sorrow, which we might talk about later. But you've also adapted other writers' work. So you've done screen adaptations of Far From the Madding Crowd, you've done Great Expectations. What's easier, to kill your own darlings or kill someone else's darlings?
Oh, yes, no, other people's. Always. I mean, I worked on an adaptation of Edward St. Aubyn's Patrick Melrose novels, and it's harder with a living novelist because you want to stay faithful. I would only adapt something that I loved. You know, for me, the process of adaptation is I love this book so much, and this is why. And that's what you're trying to put onto the page. And, you know, there are dramatists who sometimes have a rather dismissive attitude to the work they're adapting and kind of read it once and throw it away. But I listen to it over and over and over in audiobook. I annotate it. I kind of take it to pieces. I try to be as faithful as I can while at the same time acknowledging that it will need new scenes. It will need a lot of cuts. But what I'm trying to put into the screenplay is how I felt when I read it, trying to find a style, a visual style, that matches the style on the page.
I was wondering, when you were talking about adapting works of other novelists, particularly living novelists, if the fact that you're a novelist yourself might help here, that you bring a novelist's empathy to the process and you know how hard it is for that other writer.
Yeah, and I mean, when I've adapted writers who aren't living, like Thomas Hardy, you know, a novel like Far From the Madding Crowd, which I adapted, that's 450 pages, and you've got to get it down to 110 minutes tops. And you're going to have to move things along very, very quickly. So the first 45 pages of Far From the Madding Crowd contains wonderful, wonderful things, and you've got to get Bathsheba and Gabriel Oak together in about 6 minutes. So you're going to have to invent new scenes. You're going to have to condense things. And the hope for me when I do that, when I make those big changes, is that if I was in a script meeting with Thomas Hardy, I could say to him, look, just bear with me, Tom. I think there'd be a great moment, potentially, where we can speed things up a little. And, you know, very, very, very faithful adaptations often weirdly feel less faithful than adaptations that take big swings at material and make big changes.
Leanne Moriarty, let's talk about your most famous screen adaptation, which is, of course, Big Little Lies. Can we go back to the novel first, from 2014? I'm sure most people here know the story about this, you know, group of school mums in Sydney and the drama and the murder. But do you remember back when this novel was born, what sparked Big Little Lies?
There are a few things. First of all, I think this was the main spark of inspiration, was a friend told me a story of when or it might have happened to a friend, anyway, the child was starting kindergarten and they came out of their very first day and two little girls had bite marks on their arms. And so, and they said a little boy had done it. And because they didn't know, they'd only just started school, they couldn't name the little boy. So apparently what the teacher did was get all the little boys to line up so they could point at the person. And so all the parents were there watching this. So my friend was telling me this and I was thinking, oh my God, imagine how you would feel as a mother thinking, please don't let my son be the one who's in front of all these other mothers is the biter. And apparently the little girls finally admitted that they just bit their own arms. But that's when I thought, imagine if they picked a little boy at random and said it was him. So that was my starting point of what could have happened. And then it was also that another friend who's an author, she was showing me pictures. I was on book tour with her and she was going to do a school trivia night. Her table, they were all going to dress up as Audrey Hepburn. She was looking for the perfect necklace. I became very invested in helping her find the perfect necklace. And then I was imagining if all the mothers had dressed as Audrey Hepburn. And also because there's something sort of funny about a whole lot of Elvises. and so I had all the men dressed as Elvis Presley, all the women dressed as Audrey Hepburn. And I imagined a big event at the school trivia night. I actually, originally I thought a few people might have ended up dead. But I just had my my little beginning and my huge ending, and then I started writing.
Figuring out how they came together. Yeah. How did the screen adaptation come about? So it had been optioned at some point. When did you find out this was going to become a TV show?
So I met Nicole.
One of those meetings.
Yes, and I still, because of my experiences, and so I'd had What Alice Forgot, was optioned many years ago. That's still sort of going on and on. I can remember my little boy must have been a toddler, because when I was first got the calls about, oh, you're going to be optioned, we were at Jimbaroo, and you know the parachute where they, and I was saying, I can't talk to you. He's got to go to the parachute. And now he's a big 17-year-old boy who said recently to me, your TV shows are good, but you know, why don't you do a good movie, like a really good movie, with Oscar winners and everything, as if I should just do that. He said, why don't you ask your tall friend, being Nicole, to do that? So those years.
And we should mention, this Nicole is Nicole Kidman.
Nicole Kidman, yes. So I met her. I still didn't think anything would come of it. And I can always remember saying to her, well, I know not to get too excited. And she said, no, if we do it, we won't be optioning it just for the sake of it. And then they did, and it all happened very quickly, which was unusual.
Well, how do you prepare for a meeting with Nicole Kidman?
I was just excited to meet her. I did, I've told this story many times, of going to, I went to a cafe and it was closed. And so I thought to myself, well, I don't know, maybe they're going to open it just for her. I don't know how it works with these big film stars. So I went around the side and I could see some people in the kitchen, and I said, are you closed? And they said, yes. But then I thought I should let them know I was in with the the movie star people. So I made sort of meaningful eye contact and I said, are you closed for everyone? And they said, yes, we're closed for everyone. So there was just a mix-up. So then I had to go to another cafe where I said, I am here to meet someone. And you could see this man thinking, has this woman ever been to a cafe before? Good for you. So anyway, she was very lovely and warm, and but I still never thought anything would come of it.
But it did, and they got David E. Kelly on board to adapt the book of Ally McBeal fame, Boston Legal fame. Was he talking to you about what he had planned, what changes he wanted to make?
Well, I did get sent the screenplay for the first episode, and I spent a lot of time writing little notes and agonising. This is the thing I didn't realise, that because I agonised over, should I say this? But then realising it's also fluid, as you were saying, that so you could agonise over saying, cut that out, and it's probably going to change anyway. Or also, it's only going to be a few seconds on the screen, so it's not as important as you think it is. Anyway, so I wrote a lot of notes, and they didn't send me any more.
Big Little Lies was obviously this massive success, and you've told us about going to the Emmys where your tall friend Nicole won an Emmy. It won an Emmy for Outstanding Limited Series, and then we found out that season two was coming. You were asked to come up with the story for season two. Did you have an inkling of where the Big Little Lies story might go?
No, they were just saying, so there's, because people loved it, that do you have any ideas for season two? And I kept saying things, but I don't want to be involved. But then I kept saying more. And then I said, well, I'll just write a few ideas. But because of my process, I didn't actually know how to just write. I couldn't write it without writing it. So I ended up writing 50,000 words. So I could have written half a novel in that time. So that was a career highlight, because my sister Jackie, when I was saying, should I do it? She said to me, well, only do it if you think it would be fun, and why not write a role for your favourite actress? So that's when I thought to myself, I'll write a role for Meryl Streep. And I called her because I looked up Meryl's real name. I mean, sorry, I was looking up to see what her middle name was, and that's when I found out that her real name is Mary Louise. So I called the character of Perry's mother-in-law Mary Louise. And then I called them and I was saying, not quite believing my own audacity, I said, I've got a role for Meryl Streep. And they were laughing at me. They were saying, oh, you've become so Hollywood, Leanne. Look at you. You're on the phone saying, get me Meryl. And I can remember saying, well, if I can tell my friends one day that I said, get me Meryl, and you actually got me Meryl, I'll never ask for anything again. And a few months later, I got a text saying, we got you Meryl.
Mm. So amazing. I know that you are in edits for a novel sequel to Big Little Lies. Mm. Is that going to follow the story beats of what we've already seen on the TV?
Well, I think it has to follow the book. So because the book was set when they were all little, so I thought I could write a book when they're teenagers. But it is interesting because when I sat down to write it, I could sort of see my Madeline and I could see Reese Witherspoon's Madeline. So it's tricky. Reese's Madeline swore a lot more than my Madeline. So I have noticed she's swearing more. So it's interesting because it's actually the American readers who will write to me and say they complain about the swearing.
Really?
Yeah, they say, do you speak like that in front of your children? And I think, yes. I do. So there's things like that. There's also, I actually totally forgot that there was one character that they took out of the show. So the character of Fred.
That's who, Madeline's son.
Yes.
Yes.
Well done. Thank because you. I forgot Fred's existence. And I was thinking, well, Fred has to be there. And then I was thinking, should I go really meta and say, Fred's just in his room, you know, he just plays video games all day long. It's like he doesn't exist. And then just move on. So it's quite tricky. And then there's also what I wrote for season two, but then they changed a lot of what I wrote, which is why I realised I didn't like that. I didn't mind them changing my book because it was published. And I always say, when people say, I hope they don't change your book, I always say, but nobody can change my book. It's there. But because that was never published, it just disappears. No, it's like it never happened. And it did happen.
On that sad note, this is The Book Show coming to you from the Sydney Writers' Festival. I'm Claire Nichols and I'm speaking to David Nichols and Leanne Moriarty about the starry screen adaptations of their novels. David, I want to talk a bit about One Day. So it's this beloved novel from 2009. It's been adapted for film in 2011, more recently as a Netflix series. Again, I think everyone here has probably read it or seen a version of it and loves it, as you can hear. So where did the story come from?
Oh, well, I just turned 40 and I was taken aback that this had happened and suddenly I was a father and I was starting to lead a different life and I wanted to write something about that journey. My first novel, like a lot of first novels, was a coming-of-age story about university and I was interested in those 20 years between leaving and entering middle age and all of the changes. But that's a lot to put on. I wanted to write a big epic love story. And then you start to think, well, how do I control that material? What do I decide to show? And I'd read this passage in it's hard to say this because it's a bit of a spoiler, but the wonderful passage again in Thomas Hardy, Tess, about a moment where she looks in the mirror and feels a shiver down her spine and realizes that there are all these hidden anniversaries in a year that lie sly and unseen in the calendar, is the phrase in the novel. And that you could tell a big story just by showing 20 days, just by showing the same day every year. And that way you wouldn't have to show the cliches, you wouldn't have to show the first date, you wouldn't have to show the first kiss, you wouldn't have to show the wedding day. You could show the other stuff, the stuff that takes place either side. And that seemed like an exciting structure for a novel. And so then I thought about who they might be and I planned it out. And that was the origin of it, really. But the intention was to write something that had a kind of big, lush, kind of multi-character, epic quality to it, but to keep it contained in these 20 boxes.
And it works so well on the page. You wrote the screen adaptation for the film in 2011. You were looking at then at, like you say, 110 minutes. Yeah. How did you have to change your approach to your material to make that story work?
Well, suddenly it's 5 minutes a year. And you think, well, I don't know how to do the wedding episode. I don't know how to do the Greek episode. I don't know how to do the Paris episode. And of course, some episodes become 9 minutes, but even 9 minutes isn't very long. So it was a very difficult process of just really cutting it down. And when you take a big novel and you cram it into a movie, you end up with a kind of précis. So I'm very fond of that film, but I found that process really hard. You know, the first cut was 2.25 hours, and so on it goes, cut, 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 cut. And what you lose is stuff that isn't essential to the story, but is essential to the character. So it's when the idea of doing it in a different way came up, I was really excited. You know, it's almost as if this new form was invented that fitted the structure of the novel. The structure of the novel means that some of the days are very eventful, so they need 45 minutes. Some of the chapters are kind of more observational, so they're fine to be 20 minutes long. And suddenly Netflix allowed us to have this range of episode sizes, always with a hook at the end to get you into the next episode. So it was almost as if streaming was invented for this novel structure. And yet, you know, a lot of time had passed. You know, suddenly I was somewhere into my 50s, and did I really want to go back to this book? And I said, well, I'd love it to happen, but I want to be an exec producer rather than the writer. I found a wonderful writer called Nicole Taylor, who worked with a small team to write the scripts. I ended up writing one episode, and that demanded that I went back to the novel and picked it up for the first time, really, since I handed in the final draft, to try and revisit these characters and try and find their voices again. I wrote the penultimate episode, episode 13, and in the novel, nothing much happens, so it really needed new material. So suddenly it was so interesting, after almost 18 years since I started writing the book, to go back and try and find Emma and Dexter, but to do it with this wonderful gift of actors, because by then we'd cast Amber and Leo, and I had their voices and their faces in my mind, and I could write new scenes for these wonderful actors as well. So it's a kind of interesting, you know, stories belong to the time you write them, and adaptations always have take some, even if they're period adaptations, they always have something of the quality of the time in which they're made. You know, so the 1960s version of Far From the Madding Crowd feels like the 60s as well as the 1870s. And it's so interesting to tell a story set in 1985, published in 2009, remade in 2022, which is when we started production, because it has this strange combination of tones and voices.
This is a book that had been so much a part of your life. It was your best-selling novel. You'd written the film and agonised over the film. To say, I'm going to be an executive producer and someone else can write it.
Yeah.
Was there fear in relinquishing control of this story that you had held so tight for so long?
Of course, but a kind of release as well, because you're trapped in the patterns which you've built into the novel. You know, the first chapter of the novel is a two-hander that takes place in the bedroom. Well, that isn't going to work as a first episode. So the first episode that Nicole wrote. The first episode that Nicole wrote, the first 12, 15 minutes is all her material. And she takes episode from the last chapter and puts it into the first episode. Because you need to tell the viewer, this is multi-characters, it's big, it's epic. You need to give a sense of scale. And so all of these decisions need a kind of open mind. And if you've written a novel, especially some time ago, it's very hard to break out of those patterns and be as ruthless and as inventive as you need to be to make it come alive. And I was incredibly grateful for Nicole and her team's invention. You know, my favorite scene in the whole show, a scene that when I saw it for the first time just absolutely knocked me sideways, is not in the novel. Because again, she had to face this problem. How do you make an internal experience? It's in the last episode, a scene between Dexter and Emma that takes place in a little box room in his flat. That isn't in the book. She had to invent a dialogue that would evoke Dexter's state at that time. And when I saw it, I was just thrilled. So we established an etiquette where I could give notes, but my notes had no particular superior rank, you know. And similarly, as a writer on the show myself, I could receive notes, which I would have to negotiate.
You've said executive producer. Leanne has also been an executive producer. Please, please, please tell me, what is an executive producer?
I don't know. Well, I don't, what do you do?
I've always got confused about that because I always said, is this like if you're doing an assignment at uni? Does that mean I've really got to produce? But it seems more like it's a... And I don't want to be the person who's not contributing what I'm meant to contribute. But in my case, it's always been a vanity title that they offer as part of the... It's like in the contract, they put funny things like there's a clause in the contract saying you will get invited to the premiere, which I always thought would be just good manners. But apparently they've got to put it in the contract. So that's part of negotiating that you'll just sound more important.
Yeah. I've got to talk to my agent because I don't know if I have the premiere contract clause. I didn't have to do all this, but it meant a lot to me. The book means a lot to me, and I love the people that I made it with. And so I read all of the drafts, and I give notes on all the drafts. I spend a lot of time in the edit. I worked a lot with a brilliant music coordinator called Matt Biffer, because I do get a little bit obsessive about music, and music is a fantastic way of establishing a time and a place, especially if you don't use music from the year. What I mean is that often 1988 can feel like is best established with music from 1973. Do you know what I mean? That often, in the same way that we don't all wear clothes from the year in which we're living, we don't all listen to music. So I did want to have a say in the music, and I worked with Matt on that. I was involved in the casting. I was involved, pretty much at every stage. I didn't read the first draft scripts, and I didn't watch the first cut, because often the first cut of an episode can be quite frightening. You know, it needs a lot of work. But I was pretty much involved, yeah.
Wow. I want to know what it's like when the premiere is over, award season is over, the hubbub has died down, and it's time to go back to the writing room, back to that solitary space and start on the next project. Leanne, is it difficult to transition back into Leanne the writer mode?
No, I think I'm just happy, very happy to be back in Leanne the writer. For me, the premieres have been overwhelming. Writers are not normally extroverted people, so it's always funny to me that we're expected to be the sort of people who can sit at desks and not see anybody, and now we're expected to come out on stage and be and I find it takes... So I couldn't write today because I knew I had this on, and I won't be able to write tomorrow because I'll be going back thinking, oh, you thought you sounded so good then, didn't you?
She does sound good, doesn't she? She sounds wonderful.
There is a few days of having to decompress after it all, but then I'm very happy to just be back at my desk.
David, is it a relief for you?
Yeah, when I'm in a script meeting, I just want to be writing a book. I mean, I want to be completely out of there because you're working with brilliant people who are very passionate and experienced, you know, and so there's a lot of, not conflict, but a lot of debate, and you don't always get your way, and that could be frustrating, whereas as a novelist, you're completely in control. And you, of course, I get notes, and I appreciate the editing process with fiction as well, but having something made is both a privilege and incredibly stressful, unbelievably stressful. And so there is a certain amount of relief, but it's also fuel for me. I mean, You Are Here, the latest novel, was sort of written in conversation with One Day, because both were very much in my mind. And I was writing the novel in the morning and then working on the One Day scripts in the afternoon. And it was strange to be writing stories that kind of overlapped in some ways but are separated by time, and to have all of that control.
Yeah, You Are Here is the new novel, and it does speak to One Day because it is another kind of beautiful romance, a really dialogue-driven relationship, but with an older couple, which is so appealing. It certainly seems like a good contender for a screen adaptation because we've got all these wonderful landscapes. Can you just explain for people who don't know the book, what's happening with this couple?
I mean, Michael and Marnie are the ages that Emma and Dexter are at the end of One Day, and they brought together, they're two rather lonely people who are brought together by a mutual friend for a weekend's hike. with a group of people. And as the disastrous weekend goes on, everyone falls away until it's just Michael and Marnie. And Michael is walking a famous route called the Coast to Coast, which goes from the Lake District all the way to the Yorkshire coast. And he wants to be by himself. And Marnie really doesn't want to be in the countryside. She hates the countryside. But for various reasons, they walk and they talk. And the working title for the novel was Walking and Talking, and that's what it is. It's a kind of odd couple road movie. And each of the sections of the walk corresponds to a section of their relationship. So it's definitely drawing from a kind of movie tradition, a kind of classic romantic comedy, odd couple tradition. At the same time, yeah, in many, and as you say, there's a landscape and the roles are very castable and it makes sense. But you lose all these things as well in adaptation. The novel is a lot about the interior monologues of the characters, the difference between what they say and what they mean. And all of that gets scribbled out and you're just left with the bare bones of the conversation. So who knows? But I hope it happens.
Yeah. And Leanne, your new novel is Here One Moment. And this is a novel about a plane load of passengers and the woman who walks down the plane and predicts how they're all going to die. A really good one to read on a plane, everyone.
Sorry.
Just explain the setup for us for this one.
Yes, so it's an ordinary domestic flight out of Hobart to Sydney. And as you say, a very ordinary seeming woman stands up and walks down the aisle and starts saying, I won't point. car accident, aged 48. And some people are frightened, some people don't take much notice, and everybody gets off the plane, and then a few months later, her first prediction comes true.
Have you ever had your palm read or anything like that? Seen a psychic?
I did, as research for this, I did go see a fortune teller, but I could tell that she immediately... she clocked me. She thought, okay, I've got this. She's a middle-aged woman. Her children have probably just left home and now she's thinking, what's next? My children, I had my children quite late, so they're still at home. But she was also, she said to me, so now you're thinking, I've done everything for everybody else. What about me? And I was thinking, no, it's always really been about me. That's not quite right. And then she said, so what do you do? And I said, I'm a writer. And she said, well, I think, sort of doubtfully, she said, I think you should do quite well with that. She said, maybe don't change what you're writing about, but maybe change the way you market your books. Maybe you could sell them on eBay, something like that. But I did, I had an event in America, and in the signing line, a woman came up to me and she had a very, she wanted a first edition of one of my earlier books, and guess where she got it from? She got it on eBay. So maybe
the psychic knew what was going on. The screen rights for Here One Moment have already been secured?
They have. But yes, as David was saying, there's one of the things I realised, the difficulty is that there's all these different characters. And so I had one, so I had a few meetings. I did one Zoom meeting and they brought the potential writer in, who was very young, I think probably very talented, young, very handsome man. But he said, oh, okay, so I'll tell you all the things I'll need to change. And you could see the executives thinking, no. But he was saying one of the difficulties is that they all go off and lead their separate lives and you're going to need to find a way to bring them all together somehow, which is why I'm glad it's not my problem.
So that suggests to me that even though you are at a stage in your career where every one of your books has been optioned for the screen, you know, people are jumping on the new novels, you are not going into the writer's room and thinking, how can I write a book that is going to make a good screen adaptation?
I'm really not. So, and I still, as you were saying about the internal monologues, I still, because I have a lot of people thinking one thing and saying something completely different. The one thing I did, I have taken from this is I've noticed the way actors, they have to inhabit the role, so they have to have gestures. So I've noticed when Meryl Streep was playing her role, she had this thing with a crucifix and she kept on putting it to her lips. And I was thinking that's probably something that she saw somebody else do. So I've just put a little note to myself to remember to give gestures to my characters, more as a way of just improving my writing. But otherwise, I'm not thinking, how could this be adapted?
David, I mentioned earlier that there is a screen adaptation of Sweet Sorrow, which is a book of yours that I absolutely adored, about a young romance in an amateur theatre group in the 1990s. I was saying a book that feels it was written just for me. Mm-hmm. What is the latest on this?
Oh, well, you know, it's a very, again, other considerations come up when you adapt a book. Sweet Sorrow is written from the point of view of a 16-year-old boy, and it's who falls in love with the girl who's playing Juliet in an Amdram production of Romeo and Juliet. And the novel contrasts the reality of 16-year-olds in love with Shakespeare's version. And, well, if you pitch that to a movie producer, immediately there are questions. Theatre is really, really hard to put on film. How do you establish someone's a good actor or a bad actor? How much of the play can you show? It's really, really hard to do. If it's a 16-year-old protagonist, is this a film for young people, or it's set in 1997, so is it for people born in 1997? Can you update it? If you update it, what do you do about mobile phones and that kind of thing? There are all kinds of considerations. And also, I'm going to be very honest, the success of the book helps a lot with the making of the film, and Sweet Sorrow kind of slipped out during COVID and didn't sell huge numbers, so that also counts against it. So questions of genre, questions of budget, all suddenly come into play. So there is a screenplay, and I really...
And you wrote that?
Yeah, that I wrote. I really love it, and it could be a lovely, sweet coming-of-age film, but I don't think it'll ever happen, sadly, which is a shame. But also not a shame, because the book is, you know, as you say, the book is there.
I'm
sincere when I say that I never write a book with this other form in mind. If it happens, it can be wonderful, but I would never mould the story I want to tell to suit a screenplay.
We are a parochial audience here, and one of the things that everyone knows is that Big Little Lies went from Sydney to America. Nine Perfect Strangers went from New South Wales to America. Leanne, is something lost when one of your stories is taken out of this place and put in another place in the world?
Oh, definitely. But as you say, it's a completely different medium, so things are lost anyway. They have to be lost. I think there are things like with the Audrey and Elvis night. So I got to visit the set on the night that they were filming that, and they all wore amazing costumes. But if it was an Australian, then you'd have the Australian men who just made a really token effort, you know. But that would be an entirely different, you know what I mean? Yeah. That would have been funny. But it was also lovely to see the glamour that HBO gave. You know, there was a lot, the homes were bigger, there was a lot more money, a lot more sex. It was a bigger, shinier thing. But that's why I was so thrilled with the last anniversary, which was my first Australian adaptation set and filmed exactly where I imagined it.
That's a lovely thing. We've talked about what is lost. David, is there anything in particular that you have fought tooth and nail to keep from one of your novels in a screen adaptation?
Yes, and then it's been cut. I mean, again, I'm learning all the time. A lot of the screenwriting process is about choosing which battles to fight, you know, and when to say, okay, that's fine, and when to really dig your heels in. There's a scene in Start of a Ten which is written in the first person, so you're always in Brian's mind, where he goes to a disco and he thinks he's dancing brilliantly, but the reader can tell that he isn't. And when we filmed it, James McAvoy, who was playing Brian, you know, he had a choreographer, and we worked on it for ages, and we filmed it over about three nights with all of these extras. And on set, watching it, it was just hysterical, and we thought, this is gold. And, you know, I'm so glad we kept this, and, you know, because it was a big number. And then we got into the edit suite, and suddenly it was just it was just deathly. You know, it was so awkward because you didn't have the interior monologue. The humour in the novel was because he thought he was being great. When you put that on screen, all you'd see is someone not being great, and there's no joke there. And you have to play the whole song, and it becomes embarrassing in the wrong way. And having really fought to keep that, you have to just, you know, accept that you sometimes get it wrong, and that it's often very, very, very hard to judge what will work when you suddenly have all these other elements of performer, director, music, running time, pacing, that you can't anticipate at the script stage. So, yeah, I think I love the Netflix one day, and I love the fact that it's kind of a bit grungier. You know, I wanted it to be a bit more kind of scuzzy and dirty and a bit more of the flavour of London at the time. And I fought quite hard to keep the music not too obvious, just a little bit off away from, you know, just not Oasis and the Spice Girls, just something a bit more interesting.
I think we're a very literary crowd here who would always insist that the book is the best thing. Leanne, do you agree? Do you think that at the end of the day, the novel is always the superior product?
If it's my book.
Yeah.
And if it's David's Well, they're two entirely different just experiences. And as you were saying earlier, that every single person who reads a book has a slightly different experience. I've really noticed that readers often come up to me and they say something about my book and they get it a tiny bit wrong. And I know because I wrote the book. but I've come to realise what they're doing is they're adding something from their own, they add things that didn't happen because it's their own imagination. So I don't think you can I don't think you should say one is better. I mean, I do feel more fondly towards people who say they preferred the book than the series than those who say, not that there are that many who would say, I actually thought the series was better. So I feel more fondly to people who like the book. But I don't think overall that you should say one is always better.
What about for you, David?
Yeah, I think they're completely different experiences. I mean, obviously, I love reading and it's immersive and personal and a profound experience. But there's also something terrific about sitting with friends or sitting alone and immersing yourself and in all those other elements of performance and music and camera work. I love all of that. And certainly in the case of One Day, I think Nicole and the writers definitely made improvements. That beautiful scene, which isn't in the book. And the book is a kind of... It is a little bit too big and broad and a little bit dated in some ways. And they gave it a wonderful polish and made it feel fresh. And I'm extremely grateful to have collaborated with those brilliant, talented young people. I mean, much younger. I, on set, you know, I was always being offered chairs and things. And I realised that I was, you know, by a long way, the oldest person involved in the production. Amber and Leo aren't born till chapter 10. So for them, it's like a period novel, and it's that's a strange experience. So of course they're going to bring new things. And for me now, that's a real privilege, a joy to work with them and to see that process happening. Often it's portrayed as a kind of adversarial process, and that hasn't been my experience. You know, it's been a real joy for me.
And this has been a joy tonight. Can you please thank David Nicholls and Leanne Moriarty?
Thank you very much.
That was Leanne Moriarty and David Nicholls with me at Sydney Writers' Festival. Thanks to the festival for having us all. The Book Show is produced by Sarah Lestrange with technical operation by David LeMay. My name is Claire Nicholls, and next week... it's a new broadcast year and a fresh new batch of books and interviews on The Book Show. Until then, take care.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.